This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
September 1989, Seattle, Washington. One of the largest fires in the city's history erupts at a lumber warehouse. Authorities soon attribute the blaze to an elusive master arsonist whose reign of destruction has resulted in millions of dollars in damage and left at least two firefighters dead. Six decades ago, Senator Huey Long of Louisiana was one of the most powerful politicians in America, a man many believed was destined to be president. But in 1935, Long was felled by an assassin's bullet. Now some researchers believe that the man thought to be Long's killer was in fact innocent, and that this may have been the first political assassination in America where the truth was concealed by a cover-up. In 1947, a two-year-old girl was found badly beaten and abandoned in a field in Weed, California. Today, that little girl is a successful businesswoman who is still searching for her long-lost brother, whom she met only once 45 years ago.
Join me for these fascinating stories. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery.
September 9th, 1989, Seattle, Washington. Just after 10 p.m., 20 engine companies responded to a four-alarm blaze at the vacant Blackstock Lumber Warehouse. When the first company arrived, the blaze appeared to be controllable, isolated in one wing of the building. In a matter of minutes, however, it would become one of the largest fires in Seattle history. Matt Johnson and Bill Meredith were two of the first firefighters to get inside.
Back up here.
We decided to explore what appeared to be a second story mezzanine type of area. While I was up there, there was a tremendous release of heat from somewhere.
The roof had exploded into a 5,000 degree wall of flame.
I'm out of air.
Two stories below the inferno, Meredith and Johnson were overwhelmed by a burst of radiant heat, so strong they were in danger of being baked alive.
Go on, Bill, give me some help.
The lack of oxygen and tremendous heat left Matt Johnson unable to move. Bill Meredith went for help and became disoriented himself.
I've been hot before, but I never experienced that. I've had my ears blistered, but this was something else. It was like being x-rayed with heat. It was absolutely stunning.
Bill Meredith somehow survived, despite the fact that his body temperature had climbed to a point which normally means certain death. The next day, his partner, Matt Johnson, would be found dead in the rubble. He was 32 years old, married, and the father of a 15-month-old son. At first, police suspected that the fire had been started accidentally by a vagrant trying to keep warm. But the burned-out warehouse had a different look to one veteran investigator with the Seattle Fire Department. To Dennis Fowler, it carried the distinctive signature of an elusive criminal he'd been tracking for years. A criminal who may be the world's most sophisticated and deadly arsonist.
On a scale of 1 to 10, he's a 10 as far as his skills and his abilities go to bring a building down. You can't put them out. And the reason you can't is because they generate so much heat and energy that a hose of water simply cannot overcome it.
Fowler first encountered the work of the arsonist in 1984 when Seattle's 40,000 square foot carpet exchange warehouse burned to the ground in an astounding 19 minutes flat. The heat was so intense that it literally boiled concrete and vaporized steel beams.
The firefighters themselves said that it was hotter than they had ever experienced before. And these guys were in state-of-the-art firefighting, protective clothing, and they're still outside, and they've got hose lines, and they can't get near the fire.
After the Blackstock lumber fire, the Seattle Fire Department took the unusual step of investigating on a national scale. They analyzed dozens of fires across the United States and Canada, and found at least 20 which bore the hallmark of a person some call the King of Arsonists.
The Seattle Fire Department now believed they were dealing with the most sophisticated arsonist in the history of the United States. For firefighters, it was their worst nightmare come true. The blazes set by this arsonist defied logic, burning hotter and faster because of the oxygen in the water from the fire hoses. In essence, these arson fires were death traps.
One factor above all others made the arsonist extremely difficult to track. He used a fuel of unknown origin, an accelerant which left behind absolutely no residue. Burned thousands of square feet in as little a time as 3 minutes, and generated temperatures which topped out between 5 and 7,000 degrees, three times hotter than a normal fire.
Here you can see some silicates which have boiled up out of the concrete from the high temperatures that we have with the thermite.
As the data developed, it began to narrow the field as to what type of accelerant it might be and actually what could be happening inside these structures. And it was something that had never been tested before. And so we went through a series of tests involving various types of exothermic fuels, high temperature fuels that had never been burned in building tests.
On March 25, 1990, after a year of intensive research, the Seattle Fire Department set a test fire at an empty shopping center in Puyallup, a Seattle suburb. The entire complex was destroyed in minutes.
The Puyallup test fire allowed us to narrow the field of potential accelerants down tremendously. Although it did not exactly duplicate what the arsonist is able to do, it reproduced close enough for us to know that this was the type of fuel that the arsonist is using, and this is what we were looking for.
The fuel, which the Seattle Fire Department has kept top secret, was an oddball mixture of several common ingredients, all readily available. But only someone with highly specialized knowledge would know how to put those ingredients together.
The ceiling heights and those rafters.
He knows the fuel.
Yeah, it's important. It's critical.
And how much he needs to use to take a building down.
Overall square footage?
He may not be an engineer, but he certainly knows a lot about building construction. This person probably has no contact at all with the people who are going to burn the building or who actually are going to, you know, have the building burned. Once the fuel is delivered, anybody can light it.
The only one of the arsonist fires to generate eyewitnesses was one of the largest, the Blackstock Lumber Fire in Seattle.
I read about the Blackstock Lumber Fire in the paper, and I realized that I had been in the vicinity of the fire approximately 15 to 20 minutes before the alarm was called in. I was driving along the road Blackstock Lumber Yard is located on. I noticed a vehicle, probably a 1970s vintage, early 80s Mercedes, coming out of a parking lot. And it just seemed out of place at the time and out of character for the neighborhood. It's that area is an industrial area. And at that time of night, everything is closed down.
Another eyewitness said she saw a suspicious-looking man after the Blackstock fire was already in progress.
He paid absolutely no attention to this fire, basically just going about his business, and she found that to be unbelievable. It would appear that the fellow was possibly somebody who had actually ignited the fire, waited for a crowd to gather so they could blend in and make a casual exit from the area.
Under hypnosis, the eyewitnesses describe two very different men. Neither one is considered a suspect, but authorities would like to question them both. The man driving the Mercedes was between 35 and 45 years old, with blonde, possibly graying hair, and fair skin. He had a mustache and beard and a receding hairline. The man seen leaving the fire was well-dressed, 6 feet tall, in his early or mid-30s. He had an athletic build, a dark complexion, and well-groomed dark hair.
There hasn't been a single one of these fires where we haven't had a large number of firefighters who have suffered anything from minor injuries to extensive injuries, you know, very serious injuries. And in one of the Seattle fires, we had a firefighter who died. That's a murder, and that's why it's important to me.
To date, the arson fires have claimed the lives of at least two firefighters. While a search continues for the arsonist himself, authorities are analyzing insurance files from suspicious fires across the nation. When we return, nearly 60 years after the death of Senator Huey Long, his murder remains a subject of controversy. President John F. Kennedy, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and Senator Robert Kennedy, political assassinations that changed the course of recent history. However, an entire generation may not be aware that 3 decades earlier, another assassination rocked this country to its foundations. The man who was killed was named Huey Pierce Long, senator from the state of Louisiana, and a man who might very well have become president. To many, he was a spirited visionary, but to others, Huey Long was a dangerous radical.
We'll not destroy the profit system. We'll not destroy the capitalistic system. We won't destroy the Constitution of the United States. We won't destroy the Declaration of Independence. On the contrary, we'll make the Declaration of Independence read in the words it was written in, instead of having an interpretation of all.
Huey Long, known as the Kingfish, came to prominence in the 1920s. His down-home style contrasted sharply with a brilliant legal mind. He completed just 1 year of law school, yet by the age of 29, he had already argued 2 cases successfully before the United States Supreme Court. When he was 34, Long was elected governor of Louisiana. He was swept into office, thanks in part to his philosophy of redistributing American wealth.
No man must be allowed to have too much. No man must be allowed to have too little. Unless you limit the size of the big, it necessarily means that the small people must become more and more impoverished as time goes on.
At the age of 37, Huey Long was elected to the U.S. Senate. He was clearly a national figure, and there was serious talk of a run for president in 1936. The very thought of Huey Long in the White House prompted opposition groups in Louisiana to arm themselves, hoping to shatter Long's power base in his home state. To the rich and powerful, Long was the devil incarnate, and many believed Huey Long was better dead than president. In fact, a few were convinced it was the only way to stop him.
I was elected railroad commissioner of Louisiana in 1918. And they tried to impeach me in 1920. When they failed to impeach me in 1920, they indicted me in 1921. And when I wiggled through that, I managed to become governor in 1928. And they impeached me in 1929.
Huey Long had a great compassion for a lot of people, but that compassion did not extend to people who crossed him. Once you crossed Huey Long, you had an enemy for life. People lost jobs, they lost businesses, they lost lands, they lost everything because of the vindictiveness of Huey Long.
Judge Henry Pobby of St. Landry Parish was one of the many elected officials long targeted for political destruction. By contrast, Pobby's 29-year-old son-in-law, Dr. Carl Austin Weiss, was known to be apolitical. But it was Dr. Weiss, a respected Baton Rouge physician, whose name was to become inextricably linked to Huey Long's. On September 8, 1935, the two men would meet for the first and only time. It was a meeting that would change history.
I'm fed up with it. I don't understand why I gotta keep doing this. And I don't want to hear anybody blaming Earl anymore either.
4 days earlier, Huey Long had returned to Louisiana from Washington, D.C. for a special state legislative session.
In my office in 10 minutes, I'm gonna climb off his back like a dog.
Despite the threats against his life, Senator Long strode boldly between the State House chamber and Governor Oscar Allen's office, where history records that Dr. Carl Austin Weiss lay in wait.
Oscar! 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 They're going to vote first thing in the morning, and this is the last time I'm going to do your job for you. You understand me? He shot me! He shot me!
Dr. Carl Austin Weiss was killed instantly, shot more than 60 times by Long's bodyguards. His .32 caliber pistol was found beside him. Huey Long died 30 hours later. He was just 42 years old. Long's funeral drew 100,000 mourners, most of them working people. No one could believe that a force of nature like the senator had been forever silenced. Five days after Huey Long's funeral, an inquest seemed to establish Dr. Carl Austin Weiss as the assassin. Some speculated that his motive was to stop Huey Long from sabotaging the political career of Weiss's father-in-law, Judge Henry Pobby. Weiss's own family, in a state of shock, had no choice but to accept the verdict. However, today, strong evidence has been amassed which indicates that Huey Long may have been killed accidentally and that Dr. Weiss may have been innocent.
Well, did you enjoy the church service,
Dad? On the day Huey Long was shot, the Weiss family gathered as usual for Sunday dinner at the home of Carl's father in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
And how is your father, the judge?
He's fine, too.
In 1933, Carl Weiss had married Henry Pavey's daughter, Yvonne. At the special legislative session then in progress, Huey Long was trying to gerrymander Judge Pobby's judicial district out of existence.
Well, that man is taking people's jobs away, their livelihoods away, and it's coming right in your family. How can you not be upset?
Papa, you just don't understand. Long is cut from a different breed. He's different.
According to those present, it was Carl Weiss's father who was railing against Huey Long that day. Ironically, Dr. Weiss himself minimized Long's actions and tried to calm his father down.
Lovely morning in church. We've got a delightful dinner here. Let's not let this destroy it.
You're right about that, son.
Before the day was over, Dr. Weiss would be dead and his name vilified. He left behind his wife and a son, Carl Austin Weiss Jr., who was granted Unsolved Mysteries, a rare interview.
Naturally, most of what I know of my father is very secondhand, but understandably, it's been one of my major life interests. Naturally, there's been a lot of interest focused on the minute-by-minute detail of my father's day, where he went, what he did, etc.
I'll be back in just a little.
He spent the afternoon at home, and then he left to visit the home of a man named Morgan, who was a patient of his, and I believe my father made a phone call from the Morgan home to make plans for the morning surgery. Thereafter, he left.
See you later.
And for reasons that I don't believe we'll ever know, he didn't go directly home, but stopped. And the rest is, as they say, history.
At the state capitol that evening, the career of Yvonne Weiss's father, Judge Henry Pavey, hung in the balance. House Bill Number 1, the redistricting plan, was Huey Long's top priority.
How much longer am I have to wait for House Bill Number 1 to pass?
Well, we just got started.
I am tired of Henry Pavey sitting on that judge's bench, and I thought y'all was going to get him out tonight.
We just started working on this last night, and we're getting resistance on it.
Oh, you get resistance every bill you pass. That ain't no excuse no more.
We just got to take our time.
Time?
You're pushing too hard.
I built this building faster than you boys are passing this bill. Now, what's the deal here?
Huey, I don't think you understand. Look, we got a state constitution that tells us how to run things.
Let me tell you something about this state constitution. I am this state constitution. You understand me? Now, do you have the votes to pass this bill or not?
No, I don't.
Well, then get back down on the floor with your little constitution. Never mind, I'll go back out on the floor.
That's fine.
You go right ahead. Yeah, don't you backtalk me. I'll break you as fast as I made you. John Tully, how you doing?
At 9 p.m., the special session was still going strong. Huey Long trod his familiar territory, oblivious to the arrival of Dr. Weiss. Some people believe Carl Weiss went to the Capitol not to shoot Huey Long, but to plead his father-in-law's case.
Carl Weiss took his position outside of the governor's office. He was not hidden outside of the governor's office. He was in plain view because he was approached by other people who knew him, who saw him there, approached him, shook hands with him, talked with him.
Three times, Weiss would approach Huey Long that night, and three times he would be brushed aside.
Murphy, show these two boys in the coffee shop. I'm a little busy right now.
On another pass, Weiss was a little bit more urgent, and he told Long that he really had to talk with him, and Long once again said he didn't have the time to talk to Weiss.
Senator Long, can I speak with you, please?
Yes. Ellender got Anderson to come over to our side.
Well, that's good, government.
Mr. Senator, can I just speak with you for a second,
I'm a little busy, son, but you just make yourself comfortable. Back in just a few minutes.
Senator Long, Senator Long, this is very important. Mr. Senator.
History records the rest in some blue haze, really, but we're uncertain as to what happened, but that is how the scene was set for this particular moment.
You know your jobs, you know what you gotta do. Why do I have to keep coming telling you what to do? No,
at 9:20 p.m., Dr. Weiss would approach Huey Long for the third and final time. The revisionist historians, who are convinced that Carl Weiss did not kill Huey Long, believe it happened like this.
All right, they're going to vote first thing in the morning, and this is the last time I'm doing your job for you. You understand me?
Mr. Long, I've got to talk to
you. Will you just leave me alone, you little pissant? He shot me! He shot me!
Huey Long was taken to a nearby hospital. Despite his wounds, the Kingfish remained very much in charge.
Now, you boys, you staying in here by me, you hear me?
Stick.
Okay, I won't fight you.
All right,
let's go.
Right.
Come on.
Huey Long had been briefed as to who the man was who was there, who they claimed had shot him. He had been given a lot of information. Somebody had to come up with a story as to exactly what happened there, and Huey Long felt that he was the man to do it.
No matter what happens in here, you keep your mouth shut about the Capitol, you hear me? I'll do all the talking about that.
Okay.
All right, and you tell them other boys, I said to shut the hell up, I'll do the talking about that.
All right, Huey.
All right, let's put them under.
Huey Long was shot around 9:20. He was operated on sometime around 11 o'clock. They went inside, found out that the colon had been punctured in two places. That was a transverse colon that runs across the body. They sutured the colon in both places there, cleaned up the spillage. They sewed up Huey Long and then pronounced him cured, not really understanding what the consequences were, but that was to dawn on them later on.
Too late, it was discovered that the surgeons had overlooked a serious wound to the senator's kidney. A day and a half later, on September 10th, 1935, Huey Long passed into history. It was the end of an era. Life in Louisiana and possibly in the United States, would never be the same again. Huey Long, the Kingfish, was gone. At the official inquest, 8 days later, Dr. Carl Austin Weiss was named as Long's assassin. However, some remain unconvinced.
Most assassins leave a paper trail. They leave some hint as to what they did and why they did it. There was nothing like this. Carl Weiss was not a man who was preparing to shoot anybody. And at that dinner at noontime on September the 8th, he was a model of propriety, and really he was in complete control of himself. Carl Weiss was a father of a three-month-old son. He was making provisions for the future. He spent a very normal Sunday, and there was nothing to incline anybody to believe that he had this on his mind. I think it was altogether incomprehensible that he could have been the perpetrator of this crime.
No one disputes that Carl Weiss owned a gun, a .32 caliber pistol, which he kept in the glove compartment of his car. However, Ed Reed believes that he has uncovered evidence that Huey Long was not shot by Carl Weiss's gun. The discrepancies can be traced back to the operating room.
Feel something here.
The official version makes no mention of a bullet being retrieved from Long's body. But Ed Reed has heard a conflicting story from a relative of one of the surgeons present.
All right, got a bullet here.
Indeed.
Well, it looks like about a .38 caliber, wouldn't you say, Dr. Loring?
Yes, I would.
All right.
During the operation, there was a .38 caliber bullet removed from Huey Long. Okay. This is significant because Carl Weiss was alleged to have been carrying a .32, but the bodyguards were carrying .38s and .45s. So therefore, if a .38 was removed, and I believe it was, then that could not have come from Carl Weiss, or his gun, certainly.
According to Reed, a second bullet was found while Huey Long's body was being prepared for burial. The mortician in charge told Reed he was visited by Dr. Clarence Lorio, a close friend of Long's who was one of the surgeons who had operated on him.
Merle, I'm gonna have to ask you to step aside for just a moment while I interrupt your work here for just a moment.
Well, what are you planning to do, Clarence? Clarence, this is highly unethical.
Just bear with me for a moment, Merle. Just bear with me.
Well, what are you looking for? My God. Is that a bullet?
As the mortician said, he rooted around and finally came up with a spent slug. And the slug was described to me by the mortician as being about as big as the first joint on your index finger. And if you conclude that we're talking about 32s, 38s, and 45s, that would have had to be a 45, which would have had to come from a bodyguard's gun because that was the type of bullet that a lot of the bodyguards were shooting.
To further support his conclusions, Ed Reed believes it is highly unlikely that anybody other than one of the bodyguards could have gotten into the state capitol with a gun that night.
Everybody who had a badge working for the state of Louisiana was up at the capitol that night. The place just crawled with them. How in the world could Carl Weiss come past 100 security people and nobody would frisk him or nobody would notice the outline of a 7.65 millimeter gun in a Palm Beach suit?
Within half an hour of the shooting, Dr. Weiss had been tentatively identified as Long's assailant. Weiss's brother Tom Ed and cousin Jim heard the rumors and proceeded to the Capitol. They still had no idea that Dr. Weiss had been killed.
Is this Carl's car?
His bag's here.
You have the keys?
My dad's got a set at the house.
Let's go get him.
When Tom Ed and his cousin went back to the Capitol to try and find the car so that they could unlock it and drive it back home, the car had been moved.
It was just here not a minute ago.
I'm not going crazy. Let's go around back.
And they found the car on another side of the Capitol building. When my Uncle Tom finally did open the car and go through the interior, he found that my father's instrument bag was open and in some disarray, whereas normally it would be packed in a very orderly fashion.
Somebody's gone through the bag.
Carl would never leave his stuff like this.
Weiss's brother and cousin also discovered that the doctor's gun was missing from the glove compartment. To this day, no one can be sure who removed the gun from the car. However, Eloy Sayuk, a security guard at the state capitol that night, told Ed Reed that it was someone other than Carl Weiss.
One of the bodyguards who is now dead, as all the rest of them are dead, he told me that he felt that that gun was a throwdown gun, that one of the bodyguards had gone out to the car that Carl Weiss had driven up in, had gotten that pistol, and had thrown it next to the body.
Senator Long, could I just have a moment, Bob, with you, please?
Reed believes his theory is bolstered by Weiss's own actions inside the Capitol.
If Carl Weiss was actually at the state capitol to kill Huey Long, he had a perfect opportunity that passed. Huey Long had his back turned to Carl Weiss. It would have been very easy for Carl Weiss to shove his pistol up against Long's body, emptied out the magazine, and then made his escape. Because of the rumors that had been flying that there would be an attempt made on Huey Long's life that night, because of that, fuses were very, very short. Something that happened that night, perhaps Carl Weiss hit Huey Long, perhaps he just moved too fast, and I think the bodyguards, who were without any training whatsoever in security, I think they overreacted. I think the bullets that entered Huey Long's body were the bullets that came from the bodyguards' guns.
Ed Reed offers up what he believes is one final piece of evidence. By all accounts, when Huey Long was admitted to the hospital, his lip was bleeding.
Your lip, Huey?
That's where he hit me.
Was Senator Long referring to his encounter with Dr. Weiss? According to an affidavit sworn to by one of those present, he most definitely was. In hindsight, there seems considerable doubt about who actually shot Huey Long. But at the time, it was essentially an open and shut case. Anyone who attempted to investigate further was stymied because all the official records, as well as Dr. Weiss's gun, disappeared a few years after the inquest and remained missing for more than half a century. In 1987, Professor James Starrs, a forensic expert renowned for his ability to unearth missing evidence, began researching the case.
In trying to find the gun and the state police files, I decided that the police were the prime suspects that should be looked at, starting from the top down, and I literally made a laundry list of the individuals with Lewis F. Geer at the top of that list.
Lewis F. Geer had been head of the Criminal Bureau of Investigation in Louisiana at the time of Huey Long's death. Geer died in 1966. In 1987, an investigator engaged by Professor Starrs began an extensive search for Geer's will. When he found it, Dr. Starrs' suspicions were confirmed.
There was a listing in the inventory of miscellaneous files listed as no value. Now, being a lawyer as well as a scientist, I realized that inventories of estates do not list items of no value. They certainly don't list them in this kind of mysterious way as miscellaneous files. And I said to myself, those are the state police files.
Another item in the will was not nearly so vague. Listed under Geer's personal effects was Carl Austin Weiss's gun.
The investigations of Dr. Starrs led to the discovery that my father's handgun was in fact in existence, and its location was eventually traced to a safe deposit box in downtown New Orleans, where it had been in the possession of the daughter of the then chief of police, Lieutenant Geer.
Acting on a court order, a New Orleans sheriff opened the safe deposit box. After more than half a century, Dr. Carl Weiss's gun, the gun which allegedly killed Huey Long, had been located. With the gun were several unused .32 caliber bullets and one spent .32 slug. Initially, many people assumed this was the bullet that killed Huey Long. However, ballistics tests conducted by the Louisiana State Police showed that the slug had not come from Dr. Weiss's gun. The discovery of the alleged murder weapon only served to deepen the mystery. If the .32 slug had not been fired by Weiss's gun, then where had it come from, and why had it been kept with a gun? Some believed that the answer lay with the official state files, which were also recovered. However, the Louisiana State Police have reviewed the files and determined there is nothing in them that changes the verdict of history.
It's my opinion that Dr. Weiss was the assassin in this case. We believe, from a law enforcement standpoint, that he had motive. We believe he had opportunity. And we believe he had the means to do the job. And we know that he was there.
The amount of time that may have elapsed since an occurrence really doesn't change one's desire to see the truth brought out. And I care probably more today than I did when I was a youngster about the truth concerning my father. If I were asked whether my father shot Huey Long today, I would say categorically no, he didn't.
Perhaps we will never completely resolve the controversy. Did Dr. Carl Weiss, acting alone, murder Huey Long? Or did Long's bodyguards go haywire, killing the man they should have protected? Update. A former superintendent of the Louisiana State Police has come forward with a startling admission that he believes Huey Long was killed by his own bodyguards. Colonel Francis Grevenberg claims he was told by two eyewitness state troopers that Dr. Carl Weiss was unarmed when Long was shot. The state troopers went on to tell a story that is nearly identical to historian Ed Reed's, that Long was accidentally killed by his own bodyguards who then planted a gun on Weiss. Grevenberg says he waited 40 years to come forward because the Louisiana legislature was packed with pro-Long politicians who would not believe him nor support an inquiry. The official position of the Louisiana State Police is that Dr. Weiss killed Huey Long. Next, the compelling story of a brother and sister separated more than 40 years ago. On a warm summer's morning in 1947, a housewife in Weed, California, took a shortcut home from the store through an overgrown field.
Oh my God! Oh, you poor baby!
Hidden by the tall grass was a 2-year-old girl who had been severely beaten and apparently abandoned. The toddler was taken to the nearest hospital and placed in intensive care. She had contusions on her head and face and lacerations all over her body. Traumatized and suffering from shock, she was unable to tell authorities what had happened to her or even who she was. The hospital staff began to call her Baby X. Today, the 2-year-old girl known as Baby X is a successful businesswoman and mother of four named Mary Jane Polk. Mary Jane has courageously overcome many of the hardships suffered during her childhood. However, she feels that the wounds cannot be completely healed until she finds her brother, whom she'd met only once 45 years ago. Tonight, Mary Jane tells her tragic story in the hope that someone in our audience can help.
How's she doing?
Well, physically, she'll recover, but emotionally, I'm not so sure. She's been through an awful trauma.
They kept me in the hospital because they didn't know what to do with me. I was not able to communicate with the doctors and nurses, anybody that I came in contact with. I would assume that I was very afraid, and very afraid that if I did speak or do anything, then I might be hurt again.
Police had absolutely no idea who Mary Jane was. They distributed her photograph to dozens of newspapers throughout Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. 2 weeks later, a witness came forward and identified Baby X as Mary Jane and told authorities that Mary Jane's mother was Lucille Medlin of Selma, Oregon. Lucille Medlin was staying at a logging camp in Selma. She had recently given birth to her third child and was living with a new boyfriend.
I'm the sheriff of Siskiyou County. You live here?
Yes, I do, Sheriff. How can I help you?
Steve, you'd ask you to answer a couple of questions for me here. First of all, have you ever seen this little girl before? You recognize her?
No, can't say I do.
Excuse me, ma'am. Could I have you come over here and just take a look at this photograph for me, please?
When confronted with a photograph of her badly beaten daughter, Lucille Medlin could no longer hide the truth.
This is my baby.
Sue, we already have two children. We have more than we need, sir. But I didn't beat that child.
The boyfriend denied beating Mary Jane, but did admit that he had taken her to California, where he abandoned her.
Because there was going to be another child born, they decided that they needed to get rid of one of their children. That was their reasoning. They couldn't body train me. They couldn't, you know, I was an incorrigible child.
Deputy, please come over and cuff this gentleman.
Lucille, I didn't do nothing.
If you'll come with us, please, you over here in the automobile.
Lucille, you gotta believe me, honey. I didn't do nothing.
The couple was arrested on charges of child abandonment and assault to commit murder. Lucille was allowed one visit with Mary Jane in the hospital.
Mary Jane? Hi, honey, it's me.
She brought along her newborn son, Jimmy. It was the first and last time that Mary Jane would see her brother. 2 weeks later, Lucille and her boyfriend pleaded guilty to all charges and were sentenced to 20 years in prison. Mary Jane, her 3-year-old sister, Leoma, and her 4-week-old brother, Jimmy, became wards of the state and were eventually separated. Mary Jane initially went to live with her biological father, but spent most of her childhood in foster homes. She married at 16, and today she and her husband own a successful restaurant in Placerville, California. They have 4 children and 10 grandchildren. Several years ago, Mary Jane began searching for her missing brother and sister. In 1991, she finally found her older sister, Leoma. But after more than 40 years apart, Mary Jane was unsure if she would be accepted.
I worried that she was gonna reject me, and I was ready for that, and I was willing to accept it.
But I sure would like to have that teapot set.
Shall we go see how much it is?
Let's go.
Okay.
It hasn't happened. It's good. It feels good. I'm proud of her. She's beautiful. She's got a good life. She's a good, nice person. Real nice.
I have 2 brothers by my adoptive parents, but I never had a sister, and so it was wonderful to meet with Mary.
It's like our 50s store.
To know that she's there and know that I can pick up the telephone and talk to her if I need to or want to is wonderful.
Mary Jane and Leoma have joined forces in the search for their missing brother. He was born James Gilreath on June 14, 1947, in either Selma or Grants Pass, Oregon. They believe that Jimmy was adopted out of the Yreka County, California hospital by a family from Oregon, and that his first name may have been changed to Donald.
Well, I feel that the missing link is Jimmy, to make our family complete. And I would like to know where he is, what happened to him, what kind of a life he has, and like him to know that we're here, and that we're his sisters.
The night of our broadcast, Jimmy was not watching Unsolved Mysteries, but his adopted sister was. She immediately called her mother, who then contacted Jimmy. His name is now Donald Barrow, and he was just as anxious to meet his sisters as they were to meet him. 2 weeks after our broadcast, Donald and his family drove from their home in Fresno, California, to Mary's home in Placerville. Donald, Mary, and Leoma had not seen each other in 45 years.
You must be Donald.
I am.
Oh, we didn't think you were going to make it.
The one thing that I was concerned about is, was it going to be okay?
God, you look so good.
There is a resemblance.
And I knew when I met him out of the car that it is okay. And I am so happy.
We didn't think good because we just thought of that this morning.
I just think that seeing him and knowing that he's had a good life, that was something that Mary and I both were concerned with. That we wanted to make sure that he'd had a good life, and knowing that he did makes us very happy.
I'm not very good at emotions, so I don't know how to explain all of them that were going through my mind, but there were a lot of them. And there still are. Now I'm gonna find out what it's like to be a baby brother.
And I still get to be the oldest sister.
And we all know I'm the middle child.
On our next Unsolved Mysteries, in June of 1992, two brothers and their girlfriends left Los Angeles and journeyed to the beautiful beaches of Mexico. But the weekend getaway quickly turned tragic when 29-year-old Mario Amato was arrested and then found dead in a jail cell just 90 minutes later. His family and friends are convinced he was murdered. Join me next time for this intriguing case and three other fascinating stories on another edition of Unsolved Mysteries.